I am so looking forward to attending the NPR ball tonight. It will be ever so wonderful. Maybe I'll dance with Steve Inskeep and say something terribly droll to him, and I'll go,
Aren't you forgetting something, Wolfarella?
What is it, stepmother?
You have quite a bit of continuity to record.
What is continuity?
It's where you say, coming up later on a Prairie Home Companion, Garrison forces the members of Wilco to sing a song about Jell-O mold with him. The time is at 11:30. And, up next on the media, Bob Garfield loses his temper and starts yelling that everything he ever cared about is turning to crap. It's 2 p.m. And on like that.
Oh, no. How many of them do I have to do?
1,000,000,000. Now I'm off to the ball. Maybe I'll hook up with that fellow Ted, who has all the talks.
No, there is no person named Ted. That stands for... What's the use? I'm never going to go to this ball.
Maybe you will. If there is goodness in your heart, wonderful, magical things can happen.
You must be my fairy godmother.
No, I'm from the Labor Department. You might have a pretty good case here, but you have to fill out this 1166 form. Then we schedule an administrative hearing, which is non-binding, but if we get a Class D advisory judgment, then we file.
No, by then the ball will be over. I need help right now.
Why didn't you say so? Hey, you, come here.
It's all the birds from Bird Note.
They'll record all your little announcements while you're gone.
Okay, let's hear you do the Prairie Home Companion one. I guess that's close enough. I'm out of here. Hey, Mr. Inskeep, don't give all your dances away. I'm coming. I forgot something. Can you guys record something about how this is a show about Cinderella and the host is Colin McEnroe? Thanks.
I guess that was it. All right, so we are going to be talking about Cinderella today, about the persistence of this myth. And so joining us to do that, as she has many times before, is Linda Holmes, who writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See. She's the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Joining me in studio is Maya Cantu, dramaturg and author of American Cinderella on the Broadway musical stage, Imagining the Working Girl, from Irene to Gypsy. She'll be joining the drama faculty of Bennington College in the fall. But she's with us today. Linda's in the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Linda Holmes, I'll start with you. This story, some version of this story, it's kind of all over culture. It goes back to China, and it just never seems to go away. What's the theme in it that makes it such a brainworm?
Well, the Cinderella story, we have to differentiate a little bit between what we talk about as a Cinderella story, which is essentially anything good that happens to someone nice, and the actual Cinderella myth, which usually involves traditionally a girl who is of kind of low social station, usually forced to do menial labor, meets a man of higher station who mistakes her for someone who is, you know, of a higher class than she is. And eventually she has to get him to kind of recognize her. And the shoe is the glass slipper, which can be any kind of shoe, is very persistent. So I think what has made this myth so interesting to people is the number of ways in which you can take this story, which is kind of about romance and kind of about rescue and kind of about how much you do have the ability or don't have the ability to have any mobility in society. It's kind of about all those things. There's a whole lot going on in this story, actually.
Yeah, I think there is a whole lot going on in this story. And it is kind of all over the place. It's probably popularized for the most part by a man named Charles Perrault, who wrote about it in 1697. But it existed like for centuries before that in different forms. Some, and we'll kind of come to this, some would say that the Grimm's Brother version is maybe a little bit closer to the spirit we might want of this. But so, Maya, you heard Linda Holmes talk about the class mobility and fluidity notion of this, that the station you're born into isn't necessarily the station you have to stay in. One of the things that you've kind of looked at is the degree and the frequency with which, say, Broadway producers or anybody like that comes back to this story. I assume it's more attractive as a fantasy at times when, in fact, the prospects for advancement are a little bit more locked up.
Yes, I think that's very much true with this myth. I think, as Linda was saying, Cinderella is always with us. She is ever present. There are so many countless variations of this fable. I think we are seeing a lot of her right now in particular as kind of fierce debates rage on about income inequality and maybe the decline of the middle class and all these you know, things that are so present in the news right now. I think she's certainly very present. Also, as we have all kinds of debates about gender and feminism and rapidly changing roles for women in the workforce and public life, I think the Cinderella myth, which is such a sort of archetypal notion of femininity, also speaks to that shift as well.
When you say we're seeing more of an interest, I know at the beginning of your book you talk about stage revivals planned for Gigi, Ever After, Pretty Women, Pretty Woman. These are all kind of Cinderella stories, right?
Yeah, I think there's not any sign that they're going to stop coming at us anytime soon. When I wrote my book, we had a new version of Gigi, a kind of more feminist revamping of Gigi. We had Ever After it at the Paper Mill Playhouse. We had a new version of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Cinderella, which, is maybe one of the most famous musical versions of the tale. Yeah, and there's, from what I understand, there is a musical of Pretty Woman coming at us that Gary Marshall will be producing. And there's, I think, a Devil Wears Prada musical in the making. And that's kind of an interesting take on Cinderella that mixes it kind of with almost a Frankenstein myth. And she becomes sort of a Cinderella fashion monster. So that's in the making as well. But I think there's quite a few of these musicals that, are either Cinderella or kind of take the figure of Cinderella and put her in a more modern American context.
Yeah. So, I mean, and maybe, Linda, it makes sense to look for sort of a number five between 0 and 10 on the Cinderella continuum. So, as you said, we sometimes use Cinderella as anything good happening to anybody who's nice. On the other end, we have kind of the paradigmatic story, whether it's spelled out by Grimm or Perrault. But in the middle, we do have these stories, and they tend to be about women who are in some way or another in sort of these kind of scullery roles, although these days maybe they're an office assistant or I guess maybe they're a high-class hooker. That somehow or other, Linda, it seems as though that there's that story that's kind of in the middle. It might not have a glass slipper exactly. It might not have some of the other magical things about it. But it's a story we keep telling maybe once again because of that notion that you can get something this way.
Right. I think for a lot of people, any story, has some appeal if you start with a person who is feeling at the time that you encounter her, perhaps the way everybody feels at some moment in their own life, which is, I'm working very hard. I'm at the mercy of a lot of forces in my life that I don't control. And typically what happens in one of these stories is Some intervention comes into your life. Usually it is a person. Traditionally in these stories, it is a man. Although if you're going to talk about something like The Devil Wears Prada, as Maya said, there's a little bit of a different, you can think about that as kind of the intervention of a job. So you have an intervention that allows that person to escape what they consider to be kind of a sense of powerlessness. So very often these stories are theoretically about escaping the circumstances that you feel are holding you back. And everybody, I think, can relate to that idea of, one day, whatever the thing is that I feel powerless against, I will be able to break out of, whether it's family or any other kind of personal problem, and I will achieve this other version of myself. And I think what unites a lot of these stories is that fantasy of what that other version of yourself will look like and be like. That's why a lot of these stories involve makeovers and, coming down the stairs after you've taken off your glasses and let your hair down and that there will be some other you that is waiting out there that you can achieve with just a little bit of help.
And I think, I know that you and Betsy may have discussed sort of the male version of this in some of the superhero stories, although I feel as though you know, the male ego being what it is, most of those stories are, you were always this. It was just concealed. You were, I mean, Superman, I mean, excuse me, Clark Kent is the myth. Superman is the reality. You know, you were always this incredibly great person. You just wasn't particularly, you know, the right time to share that with the world. You see it in Harry Potter, too. Maybe he's a little bit closer to a Cinderella figure when he's living under the stairs, but that doesn't last very long. You know,
right.
He's almost instantly rich and really incredibly powerful.
Right.
And so
by the time go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Linda.
When you get into those, you also are running up against these kind of chosen one monomyth kinds of stories, mm-hmm. where somebody, the whole kind of cycle of, you know, resisting the call and all that stuff that comes out of the basic hero's journey, right? So there's a collision between what a Cinderella story looks like and what a hero's journey looks like. And there are some similar kind of self-actualization narratives that run through both of those things, weirdly enough. Although, as you say, they look very different if you're a superhero, which is in most cases a man, and if you're a Cinderella story, which is in most cases a woman.
So, you know, Maya, you could argue, one could argue, that if you're going to tell a Cinderella story, you're going to tell it kind of one of two different ways. And in fact, you can use Grimm and Perrault as paradigms for this, too, in the sense that, you know, with Perrault, it's very magical, and Cinderella's kind of passive, too. Mm-hmm. She barely even knows that she wants to go to the ball. Her fairy godmother practically has to tell her that. And then her fairy godmother does kind of everything, right? She turns the bumpkin into a coach. That's not in Grimm. That wasn't necessarily around. And the mice get turned into horses, and the rat gets turned into a footman. And so all this stuff kind of happens. And Bruno Bettelheim was very critical of the way that Perrault coached this, created that story or couched that story, in the sense that he said, you know, it's almost ridiculous. It's almost ironic, you know, what's happening there. Whereas in Grimm, she kind of earns it, right? She mm-hmm. she figures stuff out. She gets a piece of wood from her father, and it turns into a tree that's really her dead mother. I mean, she does all this stuff that she really kind of sticks to who she is. And one of the things I think that you see as you're looking at the way this thing gets staged is each of those things can be invoked at different times. But that notion, that second notion, the one that Perrault didn't really go with the incredibly plucky, gritty young woman who sticks to her guns and preserves the very best things that are inside her and then figures out whatever else she needs to do. That does show up, maybe even starting back in 1920 with this musical Irene.
Yes. Perrault is the more common source for Broadway adaptations of the Cinderella legend, although, as you mentioned, the Into the Woods is Grimm.
No, we'll come to that.
In more ways than one.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think there is, there was a genre of Cinderella musicals in the 20s. This was kind of, I mean, you could say, many musicals are Cinderella stories, but there was a specific 1920s genre called the Cinderella musical. Examples include Irene, Sally. They were usually named after the plucky young working woman of the title who, you know, tended to work as a shop girl or a waitress or a chorus girl who, in some ways is going after her own professional goals, but maybe there is a Prince Charming in the mix. And there is usually a source of magical intervention in these fables. You know, somebody, usually a male fairy godmother figure in these shows, comes along at just the right time to help her get to the ball and meet the prince and overcome his snobbish family, often to marry him. And, you know, they live happily ever after. So there's a very common version of that in the 20s. And, you know, that goes all the way up to the 50s when, you know, we see this myth remade in My Fair Lady and Gigi and some of these tales. But I do think, there is more of maybe a passive presence in the Perrault than in the Grimm, which I think Disney really took to the extreme in 1950. She is repeatedly rescued in the 1950 film, first by, you know, the mice, her, you know, gang of mice who, you know, sew her gown together, then by, you know, the fairy godmother who happens, upon Cinderella at the kind of height of her distress. She's a kind of sobbing mess, and the fairy godmother comes along and gives her her beautiful gown and carriage and all, pumpkins and all, and then finally her rescue by the prince. So I think this version we have in pop culture of Cinderella as this weepy, passive, helpless doormat owes, you know, maybe more to Walt Disney than to Perrault.
Let's hear a little bit of what it sounded like in 1919, I guess, probably. This is this musical, Irene. Maybe you can tell us a little bit more about it after we hear it. But we'll just hear a few seconds of, I think, Edith Day singing in this role of Irene.
I once had a girl, it was almost new. Oh, the daintiest thing, it was sweet and it blue. With little forget-me-not stay here and there. When I had it on, I walked on the earth. And it wore, and it wore, and it wore. And it went.
Well, you can just draw a straight line from that to Hamilton, but but this was an incredibly popular musical, right?
Yes. Irene, it was revived in the 70s for Debbie Reynolds. And by then it was seen as sort of a shop-worn, tired, nostalgic, fun, but, you know, kind of a tired show. But in 1919, this show was a phenomenon. It was the show that launched this 20s Cinderella musical genre. And there were productions of it in Buenos Aires and in really all around the world. You know, it was kind of almost a franchise. There were so many productions of it. And it really set off this. There were earlier examples, in England of a show called The Gaiety Shows, which was famous for, you know, these chorus girls who went off and married millionaires. But this show was about a hardworking young Irish-American shop girl named Irene O'Dare, who dreams of a better life for herself. It was a pretty gritty and realistic depiction, actually, of tenement life for immigrants. So although, you know, the show does end up with Irene, you know, seeking out and ultimately marrying her Prince Charming, who's a Fifth Avenue Society heir, she's a very assertive and well-spoken heroine who goes after what she wants, which in this case is to lift herself and her family out of this tenement life she's living in. And this show really spoke to kind of an immigrant fantasy. You mentioned Hamilton, and I think, you know, you can, you know.
Not seriously.
there's Alger in this, too. There's the Horatio Alger, you know, rags to witch's tale, which is very much part of these narratives as well. But they, you know, they spoke to immigrant dreams at this time. You know, the musical is something that owes so much to, you know, to immigrant writers, to Jewish writers, although in this case the heroine's not Jewish. She's Irish-American, and the Irish were seen as kind of an ethnic standard bearer for, you know, the European immigrants of the time. So it really started this huge genre of 20s Cinderella musicals with all kinds of working girl heroines. She works in a shop. She's a shop girl. But there were so many of these that by 1923, critics were complaining, stop it. There are too many of these Cinderellas. But we continue to see them, and we still do. But this was, a very big show. I think it was the highest earning show up to that time, and it ran a lot of performances. As much as you can say that, you know, the ultimate goal for Irene is to, you know, get married, I think she's written with a fair amount of specificity and assertiveness.
So, Linda, you know, as we're kind of dancing around this problem here, which is that the Disney version of Cinderella in particular it's really anti-feminist. I mean, it is kind of, you know, you're a wonderful person, you're a nice person, people need to see that. But other than that, you just sort of stand there and be nice, and then birds take care of you and fairy godmothers take care of you and all kinds of people take care of you and they rescue you. And it's kind of not really the kind of message that you want to send to young women. And so it seems as though there's this wrestling match that goes on with it all the time. And the movie and I guess soon to be – well, actually, I know the people who are working on the stage version of Ever After. So soon to be stage version of Ever After. Linda, this is an example of trying to tell the Cinderella story but in a less passive way. Remind people what this is about.
Ever After is a film where Drew Barrymore played the Cinderella character, who in this movie is named Danielle. And Cinderella, Cinderella is a nickname that she's kind of taunted with. And she's significantly more, I guess you would say in traditional terms, spunky or feisty in this version than the Cinderellas of certainly the Disney or even the Rodgers and Hammerstein, some of the other ones that are more familiar. And she, there is more, a little bit more of a relationship with the prince. In some of these versions, you have someone who essentially is supposed to be her true love, who she's barely spoken to. There's a little more effort made in that movie to introduce the idea that he likes her because he's talked to her and he thinks she's smart. And they are developing a little bit of a rapport. He still doesn't really know who she is. He's, again, mistaken as to who she is. So there's a little more effort put into making the relationship feel more real. There's a replacement of the fairy godmother figure with Leonardo da Vinci, which I think is a particularly charming and very pointed replacement of a magical figure with a figure of science.
Mm-hmm.
And the relationships with the mother and the stepsisters. The mother is played by Angelica Houston, and she's still very wicked. But one of the stepsisters is a kind person, so that you don't have a situation where everyone in her life, all the women in her life, are treacherous and terrible, except for the magical fairy godmother, which is how a lot of Cinderella stories read.
You know, we need to talk a little bit also about how transferable this story is from its kind of basically white context. I mean, Cinderella's usually pretty
right.
white. They did it again recently with a very lovely woman who played Rose in Downton Abbey. But everybody looked kind of like the way that they do in Cinderella. But it's not always that way. And Maya, there are some pretty interesting examples, including, I was not aware of this one, Truman Capote's House of Flowers with Diane Carroll as a black Cinderella.
Yeah, there's a number of black Cinderella musicals in the period that I'm looking at. House of Flowers starred Diane Carroll as a prostitute, although in the show it's kind of, you know, more ambiguous. Is she not a prostitute? There's, you know, a whole subgenre of Cinderella prostitute motifs that I look at. So that's one example. I watched quite a bit of Josephine Baker movie musicals from the early 30s, where she played a Cinderella figure, Zuzu, Princess Tam-Tam. But her characters do live out these sort of Cinderella narratives she becomes a star in the French music hall in Zuzu. But, you know, there's always some kind of compromise. The prince who she becomes involved with, or the prince counterpart, is always white. She always loses him. So there's always some sort of compromise, even though her characters do attain some version of, you know, the Cinderella fantasy. And Baker, you know, had really lived that out in her real life. But there is a persistent coding of the Cinderella character in the first half of the 20th century as white, and that's really one of the most problematic things about it. I think we're seeing that open up more. The recent Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella revival, Kiki Palmer, who was so wonderful in Grease Live, came in and did the role. This is coming from the film world.
And Kate, we should say, came in and did that role kind of on a colorblind basis, too.
It wasn't
we're not going to do a black Cinderella
cast.
Here. It was just, here's Cinderella. Mm-hmm. This is what color she happens to be right this moment.
Yeah. And of course, there was the Disney version with Brandy. And Whitney Houston in the 90s. And again, it wasn't making a point of her blackness. It was just opening the representation up a little more had been.
And to that point, Linda, you know, so that's all, that can be a problem too. Like, either you're going to do it on a colorblind basis, or, I mean, if you're going to call attention to race, then you've got a whole other problem. And I give you, for example, the 2002 movie Made in America. This is with Jennifer Lopez. It's basically yet another Cinderella story. But
Made in Manhattan.
Made in Manhattan. I'm sorry.
Made in Manhattan.
Sorry about that. Made in Manhattan. So one of the criticisms of Made in Manhattan, though, is that it suggests, I mean, we're always dealing with this kind of gold digger question of upward mobility, right? And one of the criticisms that was made pretty on a more kind of almost scholarly basis of Made in Manhattan was that now the argument is that the way to rise in America is to marry into Anglo society, which a number of people found fundamentally offensive.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, a lot of problems with representation and race and entertainment arise directly from the failure to reckon with it on an industry-wide level, so that you have such scarcity of representation that every individual piece of representation that you do get becomes incredibly loaded and is heavily coded with this is what we think Jennifer Lopez as an actress ought to play, a maid attempting to marry a white actor. where if you had better representation, if you had more people in more things, some of these, you know, the idea of having Jennifer Lopez play your Cinderella character and Ralph Fiennes play your prince character, it's not that it's not that you don't still have to be conscious of that, but it becomes less loaded if there's not such scarcity. And I think that's one example of where until you deal with things on an industry-wide level and you start giving more of all kinds of roles to people, then anytime Jennifer Lopez is playing a maid, it's going to ping things for people that are based in part on the scarcity of the number of times that you see a woman of color as the Cinderella character in a story like that.
Somehow, I don't think we're ever going to see Jennifer Lopez play a maid again. The plausibility of that is actually kind of gone at this point. I do have to just quickly mention, because there's one completely hilarious detail about this. I've never actually seen this movie, but there was actually sort of a series of movies that I think the Disney Channel did or some aspect of Disney did called This Cinderella Story, That Cinderella Story. So Selena Gomez was Cinderella or the Cinderella type in Another Cinderella Story, which was made in 2008. The thing that I love, the thing that locates it so perfectly in 2008, do you know what the glass slipper substitute was in that one?
Is this the one where it was the cell phone?
Well, it's a Zune.
Oh, a Zune.
It's a
okay.
Zune.
I think I think maybe in the one, there was also one where it was Haley Duff? Hillary
yeah,
Duff?
Hillary
one
Duff,
of
yeah.
The,
yeah.
Hillary Duff.
She did the first one.
And
yeah.
It was the cell phone, I
yeah.
think, in that one. It was like a flip phone.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, it depends on what year you're doing it in. And that's what I found when I looked at a gazillion versions of this story, is that it's infinitely extensible based on the moment in time when you're writing it, and you know it picks up all the characteristics of whatever its moment is.
For people
like
who,
a Zune,
yeah. For people who, Zune was this kind of piece of Microsoft hardware that couldn't have lasted more than 10 years. I don't think it lasted 10 years. I mean, it's the kind of thing where if you watch it now, you'll have to find the one person in the room who remembers what a Zune was. But it was sort of like a music playing device, as I recall. Anyway, I love that it's there. We're going to go out of this segment with, and this is something that Maya mentioned before. This is the 1997 Cinderella movie. This is Whitney Houston as the fairy godmother, Brandy Norwood. Brandy, she is better known, was Cinderella.
Such fal-de-rol and fiddle-dee-dee, of course, is impossible. But the world is full of zanies and fools who don't believe in sensible rules and won't believe what sensible people say.
Do you like Cinderella?
Yes.
What do you like about Cinderella?
Because she has a blue dress.
How would you describe a modern-day Cinderella?
Somebody who is a good person at heart and does a lot of things for other people and probably doesn't get the recognition they deserve.
She's like a strong woman that wants something and goes out and she gets it on her own accord.
Probably Cinderella being the prince, because today she would fight right out of there and do what she wanted to do and have a job and make her own way and be a prince and not just a princess.
Do you guys like Cinderella?
No.
Yeah.
No.
The first thing I think about when I think about Cinderella, aside from the Disney movie, is there was a meme I saw recently that was great. It said, Cinderella never asked for a prince. All she asked for was a night off and a dress.
I like that. All right. Those are voices from the streets that were gathered by two of our wonderful interns, Olivia Piper and Adriana Smith. I think they were in Blueback Square in West Hartford. All right. So we're talking about the Cinderella story, the Cinderella meme, I guess you could say, with Maya Cantu, a dramaturg and author of American Cinderella on the Broadway musical stage, imagining the working girl from Irene to Gypsy. She'll be joining the drama faculty of Bennington College in the fall. Linda Holmes is with us from the studios of NPR in Washington, D.C. She writes and edits NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See, and is the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Also joining us by phone, we thought we should actually talk to somebody who's been Cinderella. So joining us by phone is Heather Curran, Cinderella in a production of Into the Woods on Fire Island in the Pines. So before we talk to Heather, let's maybe just pause over this for a second. And Maya, I'm going to go to you for a second. We've kind of alluded to the kind of the problem of Cinderella, right? I mean, it just really doesn't make sense if you tell it the Perrault way and try to marry that perfectly with modern sensibilities. But one of the things that Sondheim and James Lapine do in Into the Woods is they have a Cinderella who's kind of who's maybe even asking some of the questions a modern woman would ask. Okay, do I want all this stuff to happen to me?
Yeah, she very much is. She asks, what do I want? How can I know what I want if it hasn't happened yet? And she's an ambivalent Cinderella. And Sondheim, you know, actually writes in his book, Look, I Made a Hat, he's drawn to the Grimm version over the Perrault Cinderella for several reasons. The Grimm is certainly grimmer and darker and thus a little more well-fitted to contemporary sensibilities. We have, you know, the stepsisters cutting off their heels to fit the shoe. And, you know, that's certainly something you don't find in Perrault. But she's an ambivalent Cinderella in Grimm. She actually leaves the ball of her own accord. There's no magical curfew given to her by the fairy godmother. She just decides to leave the ball. So Sondheim talks about that being sort of, you know, a puzzle for the dramatist, for him and James Lapine to figure out why does she leave? Why, when you could have a golden dress and a prince and leave the cinders behind, which you want to go back home, which, you know, she does. She runs home, you know, twice ultimately before, getting her slipper stuck in the pitch and into the woods, leaving it there so she doesn't have to make the decision. But yes, she is a complex, a psychologically complicated and ambivalent Cinderella who at the same time makes her own choices. She wills herself to the ball. And there it's a more matriarchal version of the tale too. There's this thing with her, her dead mother.
Actually, I'm going to pause you there because I just want to. So, just people who've never heard "Into the Woods," I want them to hear a little bit of Cinderella's ambivalence. This is the song "On the Steps of the Palace."
It's your first big decision. The choice isn't easy to make. To arrive on a ball is exciting and all. Once you're there, though, it's scary. And it's fun to deceive when you know you can leave, but you have to be wary. There's a lot that's at stake, but you've stalled long enough, cause you're still standing stuck in the stuff on the steps. Better run along home and avoid the collision. Even though they don't care, you'll be better off there, where there's nothing to choose, so there's nothing to lose. So you pry up your shoes, then from out of the blue, and without any guide, you know what your decision is, which is not to decide. You'll just leave him a clue.
Okay, I could listen. I love that song so much. Anyway, so and so Linda Holmes, the other thing that this musical does before we get to somebody who's been Cinderella in this musical, it does something that sort of the postmodern fairy tale treatment, we get it from a lot of different places, certainly the works of Gregory Maguire that get turned into things like Wicked, which is what's going on outside the frame here. I mean, these stories always do end happily ever after. So in Into the Woods, we find out, well, what does happen after you get together with the prince? And it turns out, you know, it's kind of a modern story. Just things don't work out that well and end in the equivalent of divorce. So that's kind of the other thing that we're seeing now is a questioning the basic premise of Happily Ever After.
Right. And there's an interesting parallel between musicals like this that consider what the actual consequences of meeting someone via magic and things like that would be. And, for example, superhero movies that reckon with the damage that is done during these massive battles in which the Earth is saved, they have just started to make superhero movies that reckon with those consequences. And it's interesting to me that mythology, after all this time, you have both, stories and films and musicals that are beginning to consider what the fallout is from the mythology around Cinderella stories and also what the fallout is from some of the mythology around superheroes and massive battles of the kind that we've been seeing in blockbusters for many, many summers now.
So let's talk to Heather Curran, who has actually played this role. And Heather, you know, I mean, we have talked and we will talk on this show about ways in which stories like Cinderella can trick little girls into believing in kind of a princess version of themselves, that standard that they can't equal. But another thing that this story does is comfort people with the sense that, boy, the problems that you're dealing with right now, they don't have to last. They can change. And my sense about you is that you have loved from the time of your childhood this story for that very reason.
I actually was in foster care when I was younger. And I kind of clung to Disney movies a little bit as I got older and kind of loved that sort of escape.
Yeah, I mean, you actually sort of, I mean, not to make it into some kind of cliche, but I mean, you kind of lived the role a little bit. I mean, weren't you mopping the floor and singing some of these songs?
Yeah, actually, in my foster home of 10 children, I was the one who did the dishes every night and mopped the floor, and I'd be singing at the sink, and my foster mother, who was actually a very kind woman, she would kind of joke with me and say, "Oh, Cinderella," and I sort of liked it, I guess, because my image of Cinderella at that time was the Disney movie, which is my favorite Disney movie, and her voice is so beautiful, And I liked it. And then I think as I got older, I kind of was one of these girls who came from not a lot of money, and I really did have this sort of vision, like I would find a man who would love me and would help me to kind of raise my social status. I feel like I was one of those girls. And now as I've grown older, I'm no longer that girl. But I think that's the path of Sondheim's Cinderella, is she's just trying to find belonging and she's trying to find identity. It's such a beautifully written character, you know?
Yeah, so that's you wind up, and maybe this all fits, right? Because even as you were being comforted and inspired by the more pink and pretty version, or blue and pretty version of Cinderella, you know, as you live your life, you realize, well, there isn't really going to be a pumpkin that turns into a coach or any of this other stuff. I'm going to have to make it through somehow. I'm going to have to figure out how to get through life. And so you get cast in Into the Woods as more that Cinderella. I assume that appealed to you also, in the sense that there is an element of realism that you see there that you might not see in a more classical version of it.
Yeah, actually, I'd been listening to that score since I was in college, and that score, for many reasons, got me through a lot of tough times. And the song that Cinderella sings at the end of the show, like near the end, "No One Is Alone," I've been listening to for 20 years, And I really, the way that Sondheim looks at characters is so interesting, because, you know, I've heard of people who went to see Into the Woods, and when the first act ended, they got up and started to leave the theater, not realizing that happy ending, the whole second act is about what happens after the happy ending, what happens after that. And I think that's something that any girl who loves Cinderella has to kind of come to terms with. Like, if you get the marriage and the husband and all of these things that are based off of some man loving you, then what? Like, who are you? And I continue to kind of struggle with that myself and kind of find my way in the world and my own identity that has little to do with how I look and how a man feels about me.
In some ways, Linda Holmes, we're coming full circle in the story of Cinderella, that in a way you could sort of say that what happened with Charles Perrault and what happened with Disney was they kind of sucked the darkness out of a story that had been around since ancient China, that has, you know, 340 identifiable different versions of it. And Linda, some of those versions are pretty dark. It's not like Lapine and Sondheim thought this up for the first time.
Oh, gosh, no. This is not even the darkest by far. There are a lot of versions of this story that involve, you know, not just people being killed, but people being killed, people being eaten, people being buried. There's one where, you know, just as one example, there's one where Cinderella and her sisters are, or the main character and her sisters are spinning with their mother, and there's a thing about they decide that the first one to drop her her little thing of thread will be eaten, and it's the mother, so they eat her. There are some very dark versions of this story that have existed over the course of the time that it's been around. So yeah, this is not even, if you want to see some dark versions of Cinderella and similar stories, this is not even, the Into the Woods /Grimm one is not even the darkest by a long shot.
We're going to take a little break here, but we would be remiss if we didn't go out of this segment with our guest Heather Curran singing No One Is Alone from Into the Woods, produced in the Pines on Fire Island.
Who can say what's true?
Nothing's quite so clear now.
Do things, fight things.
Feel you've lost your way.
You decide,
but you are not alone. Believe me. No one is alone.
No one is alone. Believe me.
Truly, you move just a finger.
Stay with us. When we come back, Colin will be talking about Cinderfella. No, not the Jerry Lewis movie. Calm down. Today's show is produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf, with acting by Betsy and intern Esther Sheetu. Our other intern is Leah Myers. The part of Bill Curry was played by Walter Pigeon. For show pages, articles, and videos of the Here and Now staff pulling a giant pumpkin, go to our website, wnpr.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, The Nose ponders the congressional sit-in and a very popular TV series where all the virile men are stupid. And now, back to Colin.
I bet Linda Holmes has already figured out which popular TV series has really stupid but virile men. But that's not what we're talking about today. We're talking with Linda Holmes from Monkey See and NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour about Cinderella. We're also talking in studio here to Maya Cantu. Her book is American Cinderellas on the Broadway Musical Stage, Imagining the Working Girl from Irene to Gypsy. So we also wondered kind of, well, is there any way that this script ever gets flipped on a gender basis? And there actually are some instances of that, and we can maybe get into that with both Linda and Maya. But first of all, we have to acknowledge that there is an idea floating around. It may not be something for which you are, you know, eligible for medication. It's probably not in the DSM-5 yet. But there's this notion that there is a type of person walking around these days, a type of actual male person who might be described as a Cinderfella. Joining us right now is Simone Paget, who writes a blog about sex, love, and relationships called Skinny Dip. So, Simone, tell us what a Cinderfella is.
Well, a Cinderfella would be... It was based on an article that I read recently in the Huffington Post, but it's a typically like a middle-aged man who is basically looking for kind of love to rescue him and change his life.
And so a lot of these, this is the phrase I think was coined by psychologist Michelle Martin. And so the notion is that this is a man who's kind of bought into the mythologies of rom-coms a little bit. He may be recently divorced and just sort of rushing out to have this incredible transformative experience. And Simone, I'm assuming that means that he's a bad bet as a date.
Well, yes, because as the sources I spoke to explained to me, and this is something I believe as well, like they're looking for kind of an unrealistic view of love. They're looking for like you said, a transformative experience that will change their life. They're looking for sort of fireworks, you know, 24/7, and it's not realistic. And quite often with these situations, because these people want this kind of experience of this unrealistic experience of love so badly, they're willing to really rush into relationships, and that's kind of a real red flag. Like, you can experience this kind of great life-changing love, but it doesn't necessarily happen, like, instantaneously. And when you end up in sort of Cinderfella territory, you're not... They neglect to allow, like, relationships to grow organically, instead choosing for this to have this instant gratification experience.
So, yeah, we talked in the previous segment about how fairy tales sometimes don't have a plan for after happily ever after.
Yes.
These guys don't really have a plan for after kissing in the rain, right?
No,
what comes
exactly.
After that? So I just want to explore this with our two kind of experts in the literature. Maya, there are ways in which you can sort of find instances where there's something approaching anyway the male Cinderella, right? Some man who kind of gets saved by a woman in a similar way.
Absolutely. There are male Cinderella musicals, for one, going back to a 1928 British show called Mr. Cinders, where that flips the script. And I believe he's a servant at a at a British manor, and she is the spunky American heiress who comes and saves him.
So if they don't revive that for John Oliver to do, they're missing a huge opportunity. Anyway, continue.
I believe it was actually revived at Goodspeed in the 80s. Okay. I was a little young for that. So that does actually go back. Ragged Dick, which is a novel by Horatio Alger, which sort of is one of the definitive rags-to-riches story, has the title character saying he went to see Cinderella at Barnum's, and that reminded him of himself after he makes his transformation. There are definitely, Cinderfellas going back. Another variant of this that I look at in my book is called The Sleeping Prince Fable, which gets its name from a play by Terence Rattigan from the 50s. It was later filmed with Marilyn Monroe as the prince and the showgirl. And in this variant of the Cinderella myth, a sleeping prince is rescued by the Cinderella as much as he rescues her from her lower status or, from wherever she is that she needs pulling up from. We find variants of the sleeping prince in, things as recent as Pretty Woman. At the end of it, she says, "You rescued me," and Richard Gere's businessman Edward, who she has sort of helped put back together, says, "You rescued me." So there's this sort of idea of a man in these fables, usually kind of upper crust or sort of cut off from the world, being brought back to life by his Cinderella. So I look at this as a sleeping prince fable, they still continue to be very present in movies and in musicals.
And there was, of course, the Jerry Lewis movie, but we promised we wouldn't talk about that.
The actual Cinderfella.
So Linda Holmes, the fact that there is a term like this, though, Cinderfella, then it's clearly not a term of approval. It really does kind of suggest to me that there is something fundamentally gendered about this story, that we can dig up Mr. Cinders and whatever else we want to. But this, it really is a story that, correct me if I'm wrong, I'd love to be disagreed with, but it feels like it's a story that for the most part, society won't accept moving in the other direction.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it is. I mean, I don't know that it's inherently gendered, but it's certainly culturally gendered. And I think you can see that if you look at the way, for example, if you usually see a story about a wealthy, powerful woman who meets a, kind of like a regular working guy and they fall in love. And this happens a lot in like your certain number of your like Lifetime and Hallmark movies, mm-hmm. for example, typically the narrative there is still that she has become cold and too driven and spends all her time working and needs the more earthy, regular guy-ness of him. It's never that he needs to escape his life of menial labor and go live with her in her condo. That's never what it's about. So you typically still see the rescue going in the same direction, even if the economic statuses of the two people are reversed.
Right. I mean, that's even sort of there a little bit in Bridges of Madison County, right? That there's like, here's this guy, who kind of puts you back in touch with,
sure.
With the animal inside you.
Well, this is the whole cowboy thing. This is the whole guys who work on cars thing. It's typically, I'm not saying in life, but like in romance, in romantic narratives, most of which are still aimed at women. So, yes.
So, Simone, I mean, is there like a particular danger signal that you could look for if you're, on a Tinder date or something like that? How do you know you're dating a Cinderfella?
I think just seeing people who rush into intimacy. Mm-hmm. For example, the guy found, although like the Cinderfella's kind of been defined as someone in their 40s, I'm in my mid-30s, and when I was a few years younger, I was dating quite a lot, and I found that there was also a lot of men in their sort of late 20s, early 30s, who are just kind of looking for, like, the instant girlfriend. So sort of rushing, like, the connection in the sense that, like, you might be on, like, your second or third date, and they're already talking about, like, a serious commitment, and sort of this unwillingness to let things evolve in, like, a organic pace, and also just having like unrealistic expectations. So I've had experiences where I've dated men who expect it to be like fireworks 24/7, so expecting like the intensity level of the relationship to be like the royal ball, mm-hmm. every single date, which isn't very realistic, because life isn't like that, and
Yeah, no, it seems like their fairy godmother is probably their sassy gay friend who's actually trying to talk them out of that vision and get them to be a little bit more practical about the whole thing. I'm sorry to interrupt, but we really are literally out of time. This has been so much fun, and thank you so much to Maya Cantu. Her book is American Cinderella on the Broadway Musical Stage, Imagining the Working Girl, from Irene to Gypsy. We've barely scratched the surface of what's in there, and certainly Linda Holmes, always a pleasure to have Linda Holmes, who writes NPR's entertainment and pop culture blog, Monkey See, the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thanks also to Heather Curran and Simone Paget.
Hey, Greg, I'm having a Cinderella-themed party for my kids next Friday. Do you want to come bring your girls?
Oh, that's so sweet. Where is it, and what should we bring? Snacks? Soda?
It's at our house, and, you know, just bring the usual Cinderella stuff. Windex, a mop, some rags.
Windex?
Yeah, it's Cinderella-themed, and I could definitely use some help cleaning up this pigsty. Thanks, Greg.